It is clearly in the state of Alaska's best interest to have more sunshine and transparency in this process.
Question of how secretive the multi-billion-dollar gas line deal should be. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, November 6th. Good evening, I'm Zachariah Hughes. Also tonight, an Anchorage girl questions President Obama at the White House Tribal Nations Conference.
Is there a way that we can get rid of or eliminate stereotyping and racism within schools?
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. And by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com.
The Alaska legislature officially gaveled out of its third special session this week after a pair of votes in the House and Senate that gave Governor Bill Walker almost unanimous support for his efforts to buy out TransCanada. But the session also revealed divides, both between the governor and lawmakers, as well as between the state and its partners in the Alaska LNG gas line project. As APRN's Rachel Waldholtz reports, one divide is over how much of the project should be kept secret.
One thing you heard over and over again during the special session was that the state of Alaska needs to start acting like a business. Here's Representative Lynn Gaddis, a Wasilla Republican.
If we're going to be in business and participate with business, why wouldn't we act like business?
It's one of the things that makes the Alaska LNG project different from the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. This time, the state will own part of the pipe. That means it's playing a dual role, as the regulating and taxing authority and as a commercial partner. And that raises some sticky issues, as the state walks a fine line between acting like a business and the responsibilities of government. One of the stickiest issues is secrecy.
It is clearly in the state of Alaska's best interest to have more sunshine and transparency in this process.
That's Attorney General Craig Richards speaking to the House Finance Committee about negotiations with the state's three partners, ExxonMobil, BP, and ConocoPhillips.
It is in the producers' interests not to have more transparency and sunshine in this process, because the more information that they control and the more information that they can limit being out to the Alaska people gives them more control in the process.
Governor Bill Walker came into office pledging to bring transparency to the gas line process. In particular, he criticized the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation, or AGDC, the entity the state has set up to represent it in the project. This fall, AGDC released draft regulations to implement the governor's pledge. The response from the three oil companies was blistering. Representative Kathy Munoz, a Juneau Republican, read aloud from those comments during the House Finance hearing.
And finally, Bill McMahon from ExxonMobil said, "We believe that if enacted, these regulations would prohibit AGDC from continuing its participation in AKLNG."
Attorney General Craig Richards was unmoved.
Keep in mind that whenever you're dealing with, for instance, the three individuals that read that public testimony, I deal with those three individuals all the time. They're world-class negotiators, and they're negotiating with you right now.
I sort of try to avoid the word secret because it implies that, you know, we're sort of hiding things or doing things that were the public to otherwise know about them, they wouldn't support, that sort of thing. And that's really not what we're talking about.
Miles Baker is vice president for external affairs at AGDC. He says, yes, there are agreements whose very existence is secret. There are even confidentiality agreements whose existence is confidential. He says that's not uncommon in the private sector, where the simple fact that you're having a conversation with one company could be a key piece of information for a competitor. In the business world, Baker says the assumption is everything is confidential, and you make things public on a case-by-case basis. AGDC's regulations try to take the opposite approach. Things are assumed to be public unless they fall into specific categories.
And so we've been working to see if we can't, to use your word, square the private sector concerns of our partners with the governor's desire for us to do as much of the public's business in public as possible.
Again, it's really about preserving competitiveness. It's not about being secret. It's not about hiding information.
Lydia Johnson is the technical manager for the Alaska LNG project and an ExxonMobil employee. She says most vendors won't even sit down and talk about their technology without everyone at the table signing a non-disclosure agreement. By the time the project is over, she says, there will be hundreds of them.
Our understanding is that AGDC would not be able to sign these agreements. And so what that would mean would be that their staff would not be able to participate in these discussions.
That struck a chord with Republicans in the House. After weeks of demanding more information about the project, lawmakers found themselves demanding less. Representative Lance Pruitt, an Anchorage Republican, summed up his concerns this way.
As someone who's been in a lot of sun, when you get too much sun, you get burned.
AGDC's regulations are still in draft form. The corporation expects to take another round of public comment before making any decision on whether to adopt the regulations or revise them further. Either way, they're likely to be on the agenda again the next time lawmakers meet in Juneau. From the Energy Desk, I'm Rachel Waltholz.
Politicians and captains of industry would give a small fortune for this invitation, but a 16-year-old Anchorage girl had an hour-long discussion yesterday with the President of the United States. The opportunity came as President Obama addressed the White House Tribal Nations Conference, an annual event that started with his administration. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
Obama started his address at the podium.
You know, when I ran for office, I pledged to build a true nation-to-nation relationship with all of you, and back then, I was just a young, adopted son of the Crow Nation. Didn't have any gray hair. Now I am President Barack Black Eagle.
Instead of a long speech, Obama sat for an armchair chat on stage with five Native youth. One of them was Tatiana Tickner, an Anchorage girl of Yupik, Denaina, and Tlingit heritage. Tatiana, seated right next to Obama, kicked off the discussion on a shy note.
Hello.
Hello.
So my question is there any way you can get teachers to understand Alaskan Native and American Indian students more better? And is there a way that we can get rid of or eliminate stereotyping and racism within schools?
Obama talked about the importance of good teachers and how Indian mascots alienate Native students. He went on to field questions about suicide prevention, paying for college, and poor living conditions.
It's not acceptable that anybody doesn't have running water in this country, right? So that's just a straightforward matter of help, getting the help from Congress to help build out the infrastructure that people need.
Obama has made his outreach to Indian communities a hallmark of his presidency. He's one of the few sitting presidents to ever visit a reservation. And yesterday, he spoke a few times about his recent travels in rural Alaska, including the story of the salmon that spawned on his shoe. On stage, Obama was asked what he's doing to ensure the next president will listen to Native voices.
The good news is that the tribes now know what's possible, so they can hold accountable the next administration and say, hey, you know, we're meeting with Obama and his team once a year, and they were going out and visiting us and doing all kinds of things, and we haven't seen you.
Obama asked for help on some of the questions. Tatiana Tickner offered her school's Native Word of the Day announcement as a positive example, along with a peer-to-peer suicide prevention program. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, from childhood karaoke machine to rising opera star.
One of the songs, I Got a Crush on You. I always sang that song over and over.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The state of Alaska plans to appeal a judge's decision that found a regulation further defining what constitutes a medically necessary abortion for purposes of Medicaid funding to be unconstitutional. Jonathan Woodman, a senior assistant attorney general, said the appeal will argue the state can establish standards to distinguish between elective and medically necessary abortions so that Medicaid pays only for those medically necessary. Planned Parenthood of the Great Northwest sued the state over the issue. A notice of appeal to the Alaska Supreme Court was expected to be filed today. The high court has previously held that the state must pay for medically necessary abortions if it pays for other procedures deemed medically necessary. Closing arguments have been scheduled for Tuesday in the case of four men challenging their convictions of the 1997 John Hartman murders in Fairbanks. Attorneys representing the men known as the Fairbanks Four and others representing the state of Alaska have interviewed witnesses before Superior Court Judge Paul Lyle for 5 weeks. The final witnesses were heard this morning. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, former state prosecutor was questioned about handling of witnesses central to the Fairbanks Four convictions.
During 1999 trials at which George Freese, Kevin Pease, Marvin Roberts, and Eugene Vent were convicted of fatally beating 15-year-old John Hartman on a downtown street, state prosecutor Jeff O'Brien relied heavily on testimony from a man named Arlo Olson. In court Friday, O'Brien spoke highly of Olson.
Arlo Olson was probably one of the bravest witnesses the trial had, because of the consequences that had befallen him.
There were no eyewitnesses to the John Hartman attack and no physical evidence tying the Fairbanks Four to it, but Arlo Olson claimed to have seen the four assault another man nearby shortly before. Olson's trial testimony was significant to convictions of the Fairbanks Four, but he wavered on its veracity between and after the trials, something O'Brien attributes to Olson being ostracized by friends.
A shunning by some,
and to being picked on as a snitch when in prison for his own offenses.
He was spit on. His food was spit in.
Olson has outright recanted his Fairbanks 4 testimony on occasion, including at this fall's hearing, saying he lied and was fed what to say by police and prosecutors. Fairbanks 4 attorney Robert Bundy questioned O'Brien about Olson's original motivation for going to police with information.
In October of 1997, warrants out for him.
I don't recall that.
So if he were testified to that, you have no reason to say that's not true.
I have no memory on the subject one way or the other.
Bundy also quoted an O'Brien trial statement about the importance of Olson's testimony to the Fairbanks Four convictions.
You argued to the jury at the Roberts and Pease trial that, simply put, if Arlo didn't see what he saw, and you throw out some of the state's evidence, the state doesn't have a case, no doubt about it, no doubt about it.
In defense, O'Brien maintained Olson never got any leniency for his testimony against the Fairbanks Four and denied Olson was fed lines. Closing arguments in the evidentiary hearing are scheduled to run all day Tuesday. After that, it'll be up to Judge Paul Lyle to determine whether or not to issue declarations of innocence. He could also order a new trial. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Governor Bill Walker is asking Agriculture Director Francie Havermeister to step down. KSKE's Ellen Lockyer reports.
State Division of Agriculture Director Francie Havermeister says she was given notice 3 weeks ago.
The initial phone call did come as somewhat of a surprise to me, but as I will say, I serve at the pleasure of the governor, and the governor is well within his right to replace any appointed official at any time.
In a press release Friday, Walker says Alaska's agricultural landscape is ripe for potential, and he looks forward to, quote, new leadership implementing a fresh vision to maximize these opportunities. Havermeister says she's not aware of what those opportunities could be.
So hopefully part of that vision, that upcoming vision, is to increase marketing of Alaska Grown, to increase consumer awareness of product availability and why and we should buy local.
Havermeister was appointed to the position in 2007 by then-Governor Sarah Palin. Havermeister is one of the Department of Natural Resources' longest-serving directors. Bob Shoemaker, president of the Alaska Farmers Union in the Matanuska Valley, says the announcement was sudden.
It's actually news to me. I'm sorry to hear it. I'm saddened Francie's done an awesome job while she's been in there. It's a difficult position, I think. She's worked hard.
Havermeister will stay on the job until December 4th while the state looks for a replacement. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Front Street Community Health Center in Juneau has a new permanent nurse practitioner after a year of temporary medical providers. The health clinic that caters to the homeless has gone through a lot of growing pains since it separated from Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium 2 years ago. KTOO's Lisa Fu has more.
Cynthia Matoni was a temporary nurse practitioner at the Front Street Community Health Center before she decided to apply for the permanent position. She's been on the job since October 1st and is very busy.
It's reorganizing the clinic. It's a lot of paperwork and a lot of education and developing those relationships with the patients, the community providers, the pharmacy, so they know who I am and that I'm permanent.
Matoni is seeing up to 16 patients a day, but her schedule can vary.
Some days are full, some days aren't full, some days we're available for the walk-in who wants an appointment.
Matoni provides general primary care. She's certified in family practice and concussion care. She does annual checkups, kids' physicals, and well women exams. Front Street Clinic has traditionally only served the homeless population. Since last year, it's expanded to include all low-income patients who have trouble accessing health care. There's a sliding fee schedule, and a case manager can help patients sign up for Medicaid. Serving the homeless is still a primary focus, and Matoni finds the work gratifying.
They're kind of like the forgotten part of society, and I treat everybody like they're my family. It doesn't matter who you are, we're all human. We all have the same needs, and that respect goes a long way.
Matoni moved to Juneau from Cleveland, where she used to work in the emergency room. She came across the vulnerable population there, but she says working with them at Front Street is very different.
This is family practice. This is not only managing their conditions, but it's managing chronic conditions over a long period of time. In the emergency room, you would just see them for one episodic visit. Here, I'm actually following them and following the progression of their medical care.
At the moment, Matoni is the health center's only provider. As Front Street was transitioning from being under search to becoming its own nonprofit, it discontinued behavioral health and dental services due to budget constraints. But the nonprofit recently received a federal grant for $220,000 and will soon recruit for a behavioral health specialist and another case manager. Dental is still not in the near future. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley, providing marine petroleum distribution and energy support services throughout Alaska since 1953, supporting business development while helping safeguard the environment. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. And by
the University of Alaska Southeast, with schools of arts and sciences, management, education, and career education in Juneau, Ketchikan, and Sitka. UAS, a learning community on campus and online. More at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by UAS.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugia,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Josh Edge. This week on AK, opera, Inupiaq style. Hansel and Gretel is a classic German opera often performed around the holidays, but an upcoming performance in Anchorage packs a uniquely Alaska twist. For an opera singer from Unalakleet, the performance blends a European story with the traditional Inupiat folklore she knew as a kid. KSKA's Monica Goki stopped by a rehearsal.
Kira Eckenweiler warms up her voice before opera rehearsal. A piano app on her smartphone helps her stay on key.
And so, like, I'll sing it to myself, and if I get a pitch wrong, then I'll correct it and keep singing until I get it right.
At 23, Kira's already had a number of lead roles in Anchorage operas, and an upcoming performance is no exception. Her rise in opera has been quick, especially given that Kira didn't even hear opera until she was in high school. But Kira says she was always a musical kid.
We had this karaoke machine that my dad bought, and it had some Michael Jackson songs, and one of the songs, I Got a Crush on You, I always sang that song over and over.
Before you typecast Kira under whatever comes to mind when I say opera singer, I assure you she does not fit that stereotype. Kira is so Alaska. This is a girl who's walked away from the basketball court with a bloody nose 4 times. She can handle a snow machine and level a moose. And that doesn't make her any less serious about pursuing a career on stage. Kira spent this past summer singing opera in Italy, training alongside peers who were mostly from East Coast schools like Juilliard or the Academy of Vocal Arts.
I told them I rode a polar bear to school and they believed me.
This holiday season, Kira's northern roots and Inupiaq heritage are coming to the stage in a big way, polar bear not included. As the rest of the opera ensemble trickles into the recital hall, University of Alaska Anchorage music professor Dr. Mari Hahn leads a warm-up from her seat at the piano. Opening night is in December, and the ensemble is readying for a whole new take on an opera classic. Their performance is called Akluk and Nayak. It's an Inupiat adaptation of the German opera Hansel and Gretel. Here's a snippet from the last scene.
So the owl brought us here, telling us to have no fear. They were brave, like he said, but the woman now is dead.
Opera buffs will recognize that music score, but very little else. Snowy Owl and Goblin Woman are not characters in the original opera, but they are familiar characters from Inupiat lore. Dr. Mari Hahn.
It was really a lot of fun to research this.
She wrote the adaptation after consuming all kinds of Alaska Native tales and stories from across the state.
And then I consulted with Kira Eckenweiler's mother, Willa Tawarak Eckenweiler, who is a Inupiaq lady living up in Unalakleet, and she helped me greatly.
Kira's mom helped Dr. Hahn find the right Inupiaq words for the libretto, or the spoken part of the opera, and she told her about the subsistence lifestyle in Unalakleet. Hansel and Gretel picked strawberries in the forest. In this version, Akluk and Nayak pick berries on the tundra. Kira plays Nayak, or Gretel.
Akluk and Nayak are two kids that grew up in the village, you know?
Unlike the original, this opera is set against the context of climate change in the north.
Like, the ice isn't there like it was before to help them go seal hunting or get ogruk and stuff.
Out on the tundra, Akluk and Nayak get lost. But they're kept safe by the characters Raven and Snowy Owl. In Unalakleet, Kira says, ravens especially are seen as good omens.
Because ravens do help people in villages, you know, they keep them safe from bears, like they'll come and warn people when they're berry picking.
I listened through several songs at rehearsal. I have not listened to a lot of opera in my life, but these songs are beautiful. They give me goosebumps. And Kira says she knows that feeling too.
When there's a really good singer who just captivates you, you know, somebody who just like commands your attention, and then they sing like these tones that just like fill the room or just have just this sweet sound, you know, it gives me the chills.
Kira says she hopes her singing will do that to other people someday. And I tell her it already has. In Anchorage, I'm Monica Goki.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. Today, we're hearing from Bernadette Charlie, a Navajo woman from New Mexico who moved to Fairbanks 11 years ago and married an Athabascan man.
Met him at an Athabascan fiddle dance. And I didn't know what it was. I knew Athabascans and stuff, but I didn't know. I said, fiddle? I mean, that just, to me, just did not go together, you know, the two. So I said, well, I have to go to see what this is all about. My husband was playing guitar on stage, and when he was playing for it, I said, boy, that sure looks like somebody back home. And And then for some reason, he just came to, you know, talk to me, and it just hit off. So that's how it just, you know, just happened like that. Sometimes it sounds to me like sloppy Navajo. I told my husband that, and I said, no, you're saying it wrong. We just laugh about it. And my sister-in-law is always she's always testing me and stuff. I said, she'll say something. Do you know what I said? But my clan's Tabaha, and it means edge of water. And when I told her that, and she goes, oh, edge of water. And I said, yeah. I said, my gosh. It's like, you know. And I said, so then how would you say it? She goes, we would say it exactly the same way. And then another funny thing is my husband's clan is Chichayu, which means fishtail. And I'm edge of water. So I always tease him. I say, you swam too close to the shore, the edge of the water. I said, that's how you got caught.
Bernadette Charlie lives in Fairbanks. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. If you want to tell your story, send an email to news@alaskapublic.org. Thanks for listening to AK. We had help this week from Monica Goki, Ann Hillman, and Annie Fight. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Josh Edge.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we are online at alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Rachel Waldholtz and Lisa Fu, both in Juneau, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Ellen Locke here in Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Fight. Our audio engineer is Mr. Ron Zastro. Monica Goki is our web editor. And I'm Zachariah Hughes. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence. And by First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. The Alaska Marine Conservation Council promotes local fishermen and seafood caught by Alaskans for Alaskans. More information at akmarine.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Marine Conservation Council. Alaska Pacific University is accepting applications for all undergraduate programs for the spring 2016 semester. More at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.